Hi, welcome to Governance Bites. I'm Mark Manijevic, and today it's my pleasure to have my old boss, Kevin McCaffrey. So when I started my career in the late 90s at PwC Consulting, Kevin was one of the partners in the strategy section, and since then he's become an expert in the governance area and is now a consultant in the area of governance and teaches governance for the Institute of Directors in New Zealand. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much for your time. So my first question for you, I'm going to start at the high level stuff actually. What is governance?
Good question, and it's the starting question for all. By way of introduction, I've just come from a meeting of three of the major sports in New Zealand, cricket, rugby and netball, with the captains of most of those in the room, and we were going through an essentials course on governance, the basic courses. And the starting point is define governance for me. And my view of thinking about this is, instead of going to the models, to ask the fundamental question. Governance is about authority and the right to act and the powers to act. So what I want to know in any model and any organisation is draw me a map of all the moving parts. So this is what I was doing just with all the major sports, from international to national to around the provinces or the various parts, however that is. So if you look at it then, the fundamental question is, wherein lies the source of authority? Who has got control and who can exercise authority? So in associations and sporting organisations which are member-based, although there is a constitution, I have two questions. Number one, who can change the constitution? Because if you can change the rules, you set the rules, you set the frameworks, you set up how it's going to work. Number two, who appoints the governing body? So if I have control of the Constitution, I set the rules, that determines how it is governed. And therefore, I can then set up the board to operate and who is eligible to be on that board. And in sporting organisations, we have member organisations and we also may have independent directors. Who has the authority? And all of the models that you see in sport, and in particular your own sport, then the local is a board appointed by members. And your national, it's the national board appointed by the member associates. And at the international level, as you and I were talking about, they're appointed by the national associations. So in each case, it's the member. Now, at the club level, the members are natural persons. At the next level, they are incorporated entities. Mm-hmm. And at the national level, they are incorporated entities with the right and the powers to vote. So map out what governance is. Who's in charge? Who has the authority? Actually, right through the structure, it's the members as they are defined, either natural persons or incorporated bodies with the powers to control the entity.
Right, and so
that's governance.
Right, and so what those members are then doing after they set the rules through the Constitution is appointing a group of people to represent them in the manner of the business.
And they delegate those powers that are in the Constitution to those people to govern on their behalf. So if you ask, it's an agency model.
Yes.
And the reason why it's an agency model is I can't actually do this every day myself. And by the way, I just want to play my sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to actually enable me to play my sport. So you are my agent at a local, at a national, at an international level.
Right.
So it's the agency theory that says not everybody can play and participate in governance. And by the way, we don't want you to. The way you participate, essentially, is by voting who you want to represent you. So the source of authority sounds strange. It's actually the members.
Right.
But they become passive in the governance aspect where we become active.
So what then, once the board is elected, what is the role of the board of directors?
Well, it's really simple, actually, if you run through what they have to do. The first thing they have to do is to follow the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've got to the rules are there, you've got to follow the rules. But the rules sit in the cupboard because you actually don't read them all the time. It's like your sport. When you're out on the field, there's no rule book in your hand. It's in your head, right?
Right.
So we know what the rules are, we know what the Constitution says. Your first duty is to set direction. Now, I didn't say develop strategy, I said set direction, because it's contextual. If I'm a startup organisation, right, from starting a club and we're putting a group of people together to participate at a local level, we've got a very near horizon. Mm-hmm. We just want to make it through a couple of years and build our membership. If we're a locality group in a province or a state, then what we want is the organisations that are part of this to all thrive. So I'm going to have a more complex strategy and I'll be looking out further. And then when we go to a national and I'm representing my national body, I'm looking down through my national body, I'll be looking at a further time horizon, probably 10 years. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do is grow my sport. So the questions are, what am I going to do? Who am I going to do this for? And how am I going to do it? Those are the three fundamental questions. The really hard questions are, who will I not work for and what will I not do?
Scoping out.
Scoping it out. And the strategy actually, the thing about strategy is, it's about saying no.
Right.
At all levels. Mm-hmm. It's quite hard because members want this. We have to say no. And it could be no, not ever, or no, not now. But if you ask me for a definition of strategy, it's really simple. Strategy is, in a governance context, is a commonly held view. The board needs to arrive at a commonly held view. It's taken me 20 years to figure this out. It's not unanimous. It's not perfect. It's not complete. It will change. But if I set a 3 to 5 year time horizon, I'm laying out what I want to look like in 5 years.
Yes.
That's my ambition. I use the word vision sometimes, but it's a bit narrow. My ambition is, tell me a story about I want to look like this in 5 years. The second hardest part is, if strategy is about no, the biggest risk that we have, and there's a very good book, by the way, called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy by Richard Rummel. He says strategy is not about where you're going, it's where did we start from.
Interesting.
And it's a brutal, what I call a brutally honest conversation of current state. This is where we stand, this is what we're good at, this is what we need to improve on.
Right.
If you have that conversation first, then we can talk about ambition. If you don't confront the reality of your current state, which could be good, bad or ugly, or all three, then we start with this wonderful ambition and we haven't got the resources we need to do it.
Right, absolutely.
So your biggest issue is, I want to be here, these are my resources, how do I allocate them across time?
Yes.
That's the failure point.
Absolutely.
I start in the wrong place, I haven't got the resources, I've set my ambition, now how do I get there?
So what then is the board's role in setting the strategy and implementing the strategy?
Again, context is critical. If it's a corporate model, the board, like a major international airline, the board does not have the skills to do that job. They will delegate all of that task to management. What they will set is a direction, an ambition. In 5 years, we want to be this, okay? So they'll set a framework. Then it's up to the executive to do that job and to work up and down and present a strategy to the board, and then there's the debate with board and management to get to that common view.
Right.
That's because it's large and complex and carries a lot of risk, okay? Airlines are a good example. If I come to a national level, so internationally it's complex. If I come to a national sport level, we want to win the world championships, we want our players to be world champions, etc. That's pretty complex as well. So there's a very similar model, and if it's national, there will be hired executives with the skills.
Right.
Right. So again, that model, the board will be doing more work in that model because they're more engaged.
Yes.
And that will be more bilateral. They'll be doing that together closely because the board is actually a working board.
Yes.
Then I come to club level. Well, it's us.
Yes.
It's just you and me and four people. And we'll consult with the members, but our job is we will write the strategy, execute the strategy, and we've probably got maybe one or two paid employees, maybe, or they're all volunteers. Or like you, they're a federal network of instructors who run their own businesses, etc., etc. It's us.
Yes.
That's right. Our job. We set the direction, we set the strategy, we manage the risk, and now it's ours. So you can see the layers of complexity.
Yes.
And the layers of demand creates two things. Separation of duties and separation of powers.
Mm-hmm.
So the separation of duties and the separation of powers is really interesting, because what we then got is we're setting the direction, but we can't deliver it. So we separate duties and powers. At club level, it's just us. There's no separation of duties, and no one's getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
So again, strategy and governance is all about context, complexity and risk and ambition.
We're talking now about delegations of authority now, right? So your board of directors has the overall responsibility, and the delegations will vary depending on the size, the complexity of the organisation. So a larger, more complex organisation, you'd expect to have some more doers outside of the board of directors to get things done. And a smaller, you know, local club level, the doers are the same people.
All in the one.
Right, right. So if we take a larger context, take like a large national organisation, whether it's a company or a not-for-profit, take a large international organisation, whether it's not-for-profit or for-profit, how does an entity create a strategy? What are the tools and techniques that you like using when it comes to getting people in a room and saying, hey, what should we do?
Well, interesting. If our direction is we want to get to a common view, I draw a funnel.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We start with purpose.
Yes.
Why does the organisation exist? And within purpose, I break it down into a definition that talks about it's aspirational, it's a call to action, and here's the hard part, it is anchored in humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm running a wealth management firm and I say, well, I just want to make my clients wealthy, okay, one and two, where is your link to humanity and or community? So in a sport like yours, you are anchored in a community.
Yes.
And if that community doesn't like you anymore, what happens to you? You disappear.
Mm-hmm.
The largest corporations in the land and in the world are now looking very strongly at why we exist and who for. And what is our social responsibility to humanity, internationally or across it. And they're now being called to account for that. So this emergence of environmental and social governance is real.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing in the Western world in particular where they now have to report on their environmental performance.
Yes.
And that's external, international reporting. And in New Zealand we have the External Reporting Board. You'll be familiar with that. You now report as part of your financials environmental.
Yes. Yeah.
That's part of your duty to society at large, humanity. What the emerging part of social, of governance is the social aspect, which is completely cultural. So if I go international, governance is very influenced outside of the legal structure to the cultural and social norms of that country.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked in New Zealand, Australia, and across six countries in Asia, Southeast Asia. Governance in China is different from Japan, is very different from, say, the Philippines, very different in Thailand and Indonesia and Malaysia and Singapore, and I have operated on all of those. The norms are very different.
Right.
The laws are different, so you must always look at that context first. New Zealand and Australia, for example, follow the Commonwealth model or the English model.
Yes.
Here's a big difference. The American model is based on black letter law. If the law doesn't prohibit it, you're allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The Anglo model or the British model is based on a set of first principles. If you don't know, follow the principles.
Yes.
There is no consistent model of governance across, you would call Asia, because there's no such place as Asia. There are 15 or 16 very different countries. And to call it Asia is a misnomer. And each one of those has a very, very different dimension to governance, in my experience.
I expect it's probably similar in Europe, where there's a number of different cultures around Europe as well. You've got civil legal systems, common law systems, and so forth too.
Well, that's a very, very good question, because if we have the American model, the Anglo model, as I call it, the British model, the EU model is actually distinctly different. And the reason is they are an emergent model. So what they're trying to do is to standardize it across EU.
Right.
So the reason I say there's no such place as Asia, no one's trying to standardize it in Asia.
Right, of course.
That's just rude. But if you look at EU, they're trying to standardize it. There is a fundamental difference between EU and the British model, which is, in the British model, we have a unitary model. there is one governing box.
Right.
In New Zealand, you have one governing box, and then you have one international. The EU model splits out shareholders and governors. So BMW, Bavarian Motor Works, is partly owned by the state of Bavaria. There is a shareholder board and a governing board.
Interesting.
And they are two boards with two distinct roles. That is not common in the British model. It is the pretty standard EU model. But I can't say to you that Greece has got the same model as France.
Right.
But they're moving in a common direction.
Okay.
So if you then even took the two-box model and say there was one standard operating model in EU, the cultural context still applies.
Yes, it's a different country. So having said that, how about how much difference there is in governance in different parts of the world? What's the same? What's similar about governance across the world?
With respect to the varying cultures which have got different hierarchies north of New Zealand and across the globe and into Africa, I would argue that the fundamental principles, and I lean back into the British model, I think is the prevailing and emergent model. Where it's black letter law that says if it's not permitted, you're allowed to just find a way to do it,
yes,
that leads to catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people trying to break the cut around the rules and cut
corners. Well, look at the financial meltdowns that we have about every 10 years across the globe.
Yes.
Three out of the last 40 years. Right. There's a common theme there. We won't go there. But if you look at the British model is fundamentally sound, and I advocate it, it says, I know there's a set of rules, but the rules don't address everything. What are the fundamental principles? And the fundamental principles of governance, I believe, that should or could prevail across all across the globe is, number one, I will act in good faith. I will act in good faith at all times, which means I'll be honest and act with integrity. And the second part is, in acting good faith, I act for others and not myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the fiduciary principle. So the fiduciary principle, we know the word's bona fide. Bona fide translated is actually good faith. So bona fide is an Anglo word. It's Latin, and it's derived from good faith. The fundamental principle is I'll act in good faith for others, and I will not gain. Now, if we put that triangle at the top of everything, the next thing that it says underneath that is I will act with care, I will act with skill, and I will act with diligence.
Mm-hmm.
I will take care of the entity that I act for. I will actually exercise my skills. If I haven't got the skills, I will be diligent and find the answers. So that comes back to the source of authority. So if I am the governing, if I'm on one of your governing boards at any level, the fundamental question I will ask you this is, do I act for the entity or do I act for the members? And if I'm torn between the two, who must I act for?
The entity.
Your
responsibility is to the entity.
But the members are the source of authority, and they're in control.
Good question. The members have their, will have, if you're acting for any particular subset of members, they're going to have their own conflicts and their own goals. Your job is to act for the entire entity as a whole, and it's the members as a whole democratically who have the ability to change the rules and things, as you said. But once it delegated those to the director's job is to act in the best interest of the entity.
Yeah, but I want us to build a new clubhouse, and you guys are keeping this rubbishy place here, and we've just got a grant, somebody's left us the bequest, and we want to spend it on this, and you want to put it in reserves. I'm going to get a bunch of members together, and we're going to vote you off the board, and we're going to do what we want to do.
Well, that's absolutely the right of the members, right? So, coming back to the role of the director then, from what you're saying about, you know, care, skill and diligence, fundamentally one of the first things a new director should do when they are appointed to a board, if they haven't already, is to learn about their job. What is governance? What am I here to do?
Absolutely. And if you look at what your job is as a director, exercise care, skill and diligence, You set direction.
Yes.
Number one, you set, call it strategy, we set direction. The number two job is interesting, and I related the, I always relate this to sport. High performance sport is about three things, as I have been taught. One, set up.
Mm-hmm.
Before you go out on the field or out on the mat, have I done all that I can for what I'm about to do? Mm-hmm. Set up, training, learning, knowledge, practice, everything. The second is perform.
Mm-hmm.
Do my job, compete. Whatever the outcome is in sport, but you'll do it again. The third is to do a really honest review. So if I lean into sport, which is set up, perform, review. It's the same. So my answer for a new director is set yourself up to succeed.
Right. Absolutely.
Learn about the business, learn about its challenges, learn about its risks. Collectively, after the board has set direction, they need to set up the organisation to succeed. The policies, the systems and reporting.
Yes.
So we set direction, we manage, we oversee how it's doing, and we manage risk, and we can trust the reporting.
Yes.
That's an expert. If I've set direction, set up the process and systems, I can now manage risk. Without the other two above, I can't govern. I can manage my risk, and then I monitor performance. And then the other thing that I do is on a regular basis, I do a review of how the organisation is actually performing.
Right.
So if you work through that, a set direction, set up to succeed, manage my risks, monitor performance. At the bottom of that, I always put, make decisions.
Yes.
Please make decisions. Don't go around the roundabout 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
And underpinning that is care, skill and diligence.
Yes, right.
That's my little checklist.
And around this concept of making decisions, it's also very much about running, about making the right, asking the right questions and making the right decisions. So not interfering into the job of management and making all the management decisions. You delegate that to management and leave your governance decisions to the board of directors. And don't bring all the detail through to the board of directors, because it's not their job to manage the day-to-day.
Correct. So if that's talking about a model of separation of duties and powers. Okay,
yes.
Good. So then we look and say, how do I monitor? Well, go back to first principles. When you set direction, how well did you develop the plan? And here's the big failure point. One is starting in the wrong place. The second failure point that really hampers boards is we set up our strategy. Did you convert the strategy to an annual business case?
Yes.
And what I want is at least a two-year business case, so 24, 25.
Yes.
Right? The failure point number two is, we do the strategy, and we've done a good job, and then it goes straight to budget. So what happens is budget then drives strategy.
Yeah, right.
If you go strategy, 24 business plan, 25 business plan, I can now monitor my strategy execution through the business plan.
Excellent.
You've got to convert it. Sitting underneath that is the projects you're running already, and sitting underneath that is business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
In 24, I look down the column and say, we can't do all that. So how do I keep a common view? We move some stuff to 25.
Right.
So there's two levels of triage the board need to know. Strategy is about options and choices. I got five options. I can only do two big things.
Yes.
In 24. I'll do two in 25. That's the highest level of triage. The next part is we haven't got the resources to do all of that in the business plan. Move some of it into 25.
Yes.
Or don't do it.
Right.
Now, to get to a consensus around the business plan, the trade-off should be transparent and on the table.
Yes.
That keeps you joined up.
Yeah, absolutely.
If the board delegates the management to the business plan, the board has missed a really big opportunity to join the two together. If you are going to execute a strategy, a paper has come to the board saying, this is what we'll do, this is the resources, this is what we'll deliver, this is the outcomes. You do not let stuff into a business case unless you've got a paper.
Mm.
If you let stuff just arrive, guess what? You don't deliver your strategy. You don't deliver your business plan, and the board get very frustrated with management. But guess what? The board should have been alert to how much they asked management to do and come to a common view on the business plan.
Right.
Peace breaks out.
Absolutely. So I mean, this actually reflects what I talk to a lot of businesses about at the moment, where I talk to them about where do you want to see your business in 5 or 10 years. Then it's very important to work back from that state to where we are today, and then think, okay, well, if that's our step back, where are we going to look in 4 years' time, in 3 years' time, in 2 years' time? And then you can start planning out monthly to deliver that. And then it's about making sure that those are delivered and monitoring and overseeing it. And if anything does shift for some reason, if circumstances change, you can modify your plan. But if you don't plan, you're just going to stumble along and not get anywhere.
So I want to see that 2 to 3 year plan, and you're right. We can make a decision and we can agree. The modification is we're moving that, or we're slowing it down, or we're speeding that. So we make the trade-offs in the open.
Mm-hmm.
And the big P politics is strategy.
Yes.
Pick two. The small P politics, and it is a political debate, and that's it's so long as it's transparent, move stuff to the right.
Right.
That's a fair process. If you move something three times in 23, 24, 25, 26, what's the answer?
Ask yourself whether it's that important to
do. It ain't happening, because that's a political process.
Yes. Yeah, right. Well, I feel like we've only scratched the surface of the information I'd like to get out of your head, Kevin, and I think I might have to do some more of that outside of Governance Bites. But
absolutely.
Thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I hope you don't mind if I call on you again, because I might continue this series after the election of the ITF board, because I've just enjoyed it so much. So.
Yeah, look, feel free to. I like working with New Zealand organisations that are actually part of a community and contributing to it. And you guys do that. I've done some work with you and your board.
Yes,
So yeah, more than happy to help, and always happy to answer a question, as you know. Cool. And what I like is people like you giving up your time to do what's good for all of us. I've never practiced your sport, but I just like to see people participating in sports, and at an international level, even better. That's adding something to the community. So well done yourself.
Cool. Thank you very much, Kevin. I'll look forward to seeing you all next episode.
Yeah, and good luck, and keep governing.